Hello everyone and welcome back to episode 37 of season 3. Holy shit, I've done a lot of these. I don't know exactly what episode total this is. This might be around about 100 and... We can do quick maths here. Let's start this episode off with some quick maths. So there was like maybe call it 20 for season 1. Season 2 had definitely minimum 38 plus the World Cup, which call that 50? 12 episodes for the World Cup, minimum, call it 53. So that's call it 75, or 70, yeah, 75, call it. And then plus 37 here. So 102 maybe. More. There'd definitely be 102. Over 102. Call it 112, give or take. Who knows? Who really cares? But we're back. God, delirious stages of the season now. Hope everyone is well. Hope everyone has enjoyed their week. It was very enjoyable for me as well. Back again, normal times, the blip 2 weeks ago ignored. We are now here again. What have I done recently? Just work and uni, just kind of ticking along again. Can't really complain on that front. Last year of uni, which is awesome, assuming I don't fail any of the subjects, which you'd hope so, right? But no, apart from that as well, hope everyone is enjoying their week. 22nd of April, the final podcast of me doing this as a 19-year-old. It's actually pretty scary. I started this podcast when I was 17, and in 6 days' time, I'll be 20. 17 to 20, so 3 years, technically. Not really, but three birthdays, 18, 19, 20, which is pretty scary to kind of think about. But we're here again, and the transformation from episode 1 to now is something that is quite jarring to look back on as well, considering that I hadn't even started uni when I... Yeah, so this podcast would have taken me throughout my entire uni. Yeah, that's pretty scary. Pretty scary, if you think about it like that. But regardless, quite a lot to speak about. Quite a lot to speak about. A lot of FA Cup to speak about. Some VAR things to speak about. Some Australian football things to speak about. But we'll touch on all that in due course before we kick things off. I implore you all to subscribe to the 2 Foot Soccer Podcast on YouTube. All the relevant links to all the socials and audio platforms are in the description of said YouTube, like of this video and of all the YouTube videos. Notification bell, so don't miss out on any clips and etc. etc. But yeah, apart from that, what else do we have to cover? Oh yeah, there's a Linktree link in the bios of Twitter and Instagram as well, just in case people want to get entirety of content in one place. Fit check, which has become a staple. It is a Chelsea 1998 European Cup Winners Cup top. It's a nice, very nice fit. It's got this like yellow and blue detailing with a white kind of underarm kind of areas with a white collar with the yellow and black detailing. I like it a lot. I like the stripy texture of the kit. I like the big badge. I like the European Cup Winners' Cup, the final 1998. Adds some prestige about it. There is also a badge underneath that says, or the badge at the bottom that says Chelsea FC Stamford Bridge. A really nice kit, a really nice fit. The collar, exceptional as well. And there's actually a little detailing on the back of the collar here, which says Chelsea FC there. I'm showing it for the YouTube people. Chelsea FC there on the back of the collar. So when you flip it around, it says it perfectly. They're nice. Improvements I would have made, maybe a button, but we can take and or leave that. I think that's fine. History behind this top, I guess. This was actually one of the very first tops I ever bought. Now, I came into, maybe I'll do like a podcast on this. I became fascinated with retro football tops. After the most recent World Cup. There's no number or name on the back as well, just quietly. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to buy some retro football tops. So I scoured the web, found a couple. This was one of the first that I got. I was like, I need a retro Chelsea one because I've got the modernized version of our FA Cup heritage one, which was the gold. So this was the 2020 year. I'm pretty sure it was the 100 years of Chelsea, I think, or maybe 100, maybe 50 years since, I think it was 50 years since we'd won it. I think, because I think we won it in 70, if my memory serves, and I think this was the 2020 year, where we had the kind of all blue out with the gold, like, retro badge and the gold kind of Nike tick and stuff, and the gold numbering on the back as well. So that was, that kit was one of the few kind of kits that I owned that I didn't really wear out, because I just wanted to have and to cherish and to appreciate. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and get more retro kits. I spoke for 5.5 minutes about fuck all. This is the best thing about this podcast. So yeah, hence why this kit is like one of the first I got. I was like, I need another retro Chelsea kit. When was like a good era of Chelsea that isn't the current era or eras that I've grown up with? Eras before mine. Won the Cup Winners' Cup in 98, in 99. We were doing well in the FA Cup around about that time as well. Get this kit, Zola, Viali, Hullet, the likes. Regardless, good kit, and kind of tease kind of well into what we're going to speak about today. A lot of FA Cup talk. I want to speak probably... I might have a little bit of a rant this episode. I might have a little bit of a rant because a couple of things about the FA Cup have pissed me off to an nth degree. We'll speak about that. And surprisingly, Chelsea losing is not part of that, but we'll speak about that. We'll speak about some Champions League football, give an update on the Prem, and then we'll move to Australia where we got to speak about some Oli Roos stuff and then some other things that have happened which have been very unfortunate. Now, the FA Cup. Before we start talking about the games that happened on the weekend, let's speak about the fact that there's no more replays. One of the very... Obviously, for those who are unaware, the FA Cup have announced that they will no longer be doing replays after the first round. I think it's after the first round, there'll be no more replays. Now, from a footballing perspective, it's actually good for the players. It is good for the players. This is one thing that I'm not going to sit here and argue against. It is good for the players because we are obsessed with fixture overloads and getting rid of games which perhaps are unneeded in some respects. I'm going to clarify my point on that a little bit later. I get and I understand, and players are probably going to sit here and agree with the decision. However, people don't understand the... This is something that I... being a complete outsider when it comes to the English game, right, and only supporting it from an external perspective and not really being embraced and, like, entrenched in the culture, is something that I've come to learn about, that the FA Cup is and was used to be an extremely prestigious tournament. It lost its shine recently, and it has kind of gotten it back a little bit in recent times. But it used to have this shine. Right, it used to have this prestige about it. It used to be this very illustrious competition. And the reason for it was because it was the ultimate test of who was the best in England, right? In terms of, like, in a knockout competition. And the scenes of, like, Wimbledon winning it and then Wigan winning it. Wigan won it, didn't they? Yeah. Wigan winning it and, like, Hull making the final and Villa making the final when they weren't, like, the best team that year. And even Leicester winning the final, like, very, very recently. It's these upsets and these mad moments that of the magic of the cup, right, which gives it the prestige. And also because of the fact that Wembley and etc. Replays were a big part of that because it became more than just the game. It became, and it is. And look, the easiest way to kind of realize this is Play Football Manager, right? Play Football Manager and started at FMSA with York City. Your languaging, I think they're in the National League, or they might be in the Conference South or North. I don't know, but let's just say they're in the Conference. Take any Conference team, right? And if you, like, work your way, get through the fourth qualifying round or wherever third qualifying round, then you get to the first round and then you beat a team in your same division. You get to the second round and you beat a team that's in the division above and you're thinking, all right, we're on here. And in the third round, your name gets drawn into a hat and you draw out Man United. You're fucking buzzing, right? Because realistically, teams in the Conference don't look at the FA Cup in order to win the FA Cup. They look at the FA Cup as an opportunity to get more money for the club that will help the club survive another 5-10 years, right? Minimum, right? Just based off one tie, just based off one game. You draw that game against Man United and you're playing at home. You're thinking, awesome, great. You rock up to that game against Man United, bunch of gates, Like, there will probably be record attendance for people who for that club, probably for that season, because you've got a bunch of United fans coming down, and you've got a bunch of kind of casual fans who live in that, or fans who live in that area who don't support York, but live in York and support Chelsea, for example, who, and Chelsea aren't playing, it's a Wednesday night, pop down and support the local and just get around FA Cup, because FA Cup football's great. And also to see an upset and whatever, right? So more gates, great. Much more revenue going into the club. And then York get a nil or draw, they go to Old Trafford, it's streamed live on Sky, and they get a shit ton of money that will survive in 10 years. That's the point of the replay, right? That's the point of the replay. And that is the reason why the magic of the cup exists, because it's the stories around it. Like, I think Chelsea won an FA Cup tie like 6-1 against, I can't remember who it was, right? Well, okay, but like, that's not even the point. Remember when Sutton got to like the quarters and versus Arsenal, and it was on Sky, and it was on like our version of Sky, wherever. I mean, Australia is very lucky in the fact that our streaming provider shows all the games, but in England, it was shown on TV. Sun at home to Arsenal, right? That, granted, didn't happen because of a replay, that just happened because they got there. But if that was a replay, or if that game was a tie and that game had drawn, there wouldn't have been a replay. And that game wouldn't have got Sky, that game wouldn't have got shown, and Sun probably wouldn't have got the money, and probably would probably be in a far worse position right now. So, like, it's this obsession with the elite in football, and I am fully aware that I'm sitting here speaking about the elite in football with a retro Chelsea top on, living in Australia, only watching majority Big Six teams, and having eight of the best footballers to ever play the game on my back wall. Right? Not this whole kind of thing doesn't exactly scream supporting local football. I get it. But I can at least sit here and acknowledge the importance of local and grassroots football in regards to what makes FA Cup prestigious, and also what the FA Cup meant to those lower league teams. And it's a massive shame. It's a massive shame. Because we're going to get teams like, Leighton Orient or Man City. Leighton Orient in League One, mid-table League One, I think. They're battling out. They're at home. They battle it out. They scrape a nil or draw, and eventually just City's quality shines through and they lose 2-0 in extra time. And everyone just doesn't really care. Whereas if that game ends as a draw, nil all, they go to the Etihad, and yeah, they might get spanked 6-0, but the fans get a day out, they get shit tons of money, they get to go to the Etihad, it's great. It's and at the end of the day, that's what football is. It's experienced entertainment. And yes, it's about winning, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And look, the big clubs bring in the most money, so I guess from a business perspective, you do have to cater to them to some extent. But like, I guess it's just an indictment of where our game's going. And it's a shame. It's a shame. It is a shame because people, like casual viewers of the game, are leaning towards this style of thinking of like, all right, how do we maintain the elite? Hence Super Leagues and stuff like that. And I guess this kind of segues well into the next point of, I think it kind of segues well into the next point of, well, I guess maybe just to summarize, I think the FA Cup is like some of the best moments, some of the best moments in FA Cup history, very similar to what we almost saw again, like on the weekend with Coventry against United. A lot of those moments have come from replays. It might not be a 95th minute winner. It might not be a 3-0 down to 4-3 comeback. It might not be stuff like that, but it's just the moments that people cherish, and it's the moments that fans who don't experience multi-million transfer deals and don't experience like world-class players at the clubs, it's those moments that are provided from replays, or at least provided from the threat of replays, that really means the most and really encapsulates what the FA Cup is about. And the fact that they've now catered to just the elite teams by removing the replays kind of like sucks out the grassroots nature of the FA Cup and is making it more of a elite competition, which is a shame, because it shouldn't be that, and it wasn't built to be like that. So why is it turning like that? Shame, massive shame. And I guess this kind of transitions well into, similarly transitions well into the cup tie on the weekend, and which actually happened this morning at the time of recording. Coventry versus United. Now, United go 3-0 up. Brentford scores just before the hour mark. You're thinking, great, they've managed to not fuck it up. Awesome. And then all of a sudden, Ellis Sims bags one in off a cutback, comes off his shin, goal, okay. And then Callum O'Hare with a shot, wicked deflection off Aaron Wan-Bissaka. 8 minutes later, goal, 3-2, insane, right? Mental. They press. Ball gets crossed into the back post, cutback, hits Wan-Bissaka's arm, penalty. How do you write scores? 3-all. Delirium. Right? Delirium. And watching, waking up, watching the highlights of that game without knowing the result. Awesome. There was no way I was going to watch this game live because I've got things to do at 9 a.m. on a Monday. But awesome, right? And then game carries on. Players, people have chances. Woodwork, people with the woodwork, people, good saves, etc. And then in the 121st minute, ball gets played down the line, cut back, goal, Coventry, with the upset of all upsets in the most dramatic fashion possible, 4-3 at Wembley against United. Just the most batshit insane set of circumstances that is fake. It's fake. Like, it is the thing that, you know how people say, you couldn't write this. No, this wasn't that. This was the thing that you do always write when you're picturing how would it be perfect if Coventry won this game or like got through and got to the final. Or if you're down 3-0 at halftime, this is exactly how you picture it going on with the 95th minute equaliser and then the 120th minute winner. But it never happens. But it did happen. It did happen. And for a brief moment, for everyone watching that game, for everyone who would then go on to watch that game without knowing the result, it was the perfect moment of kind of the very silent majority being represented through Coventry. And what I mean by that is the thousands of hundreds of millions of supporters who support lower league teams, who can't compete because of finances, who can't compete because everything is catered towards the elite clubs, is everything is catered to the elite clubs, so these clubs just can't compete. And for a moment, it unified all of them, probably except for Coventry's biggest rivals, who I don't exactly know who they are. But for a brief moment, it was just perfect. And it united everyone. And it, ironic, I know, pardon the pun, it united everyone, and it was just perfect. Perfect. Only for a meaningless, stupid, petulant bit of geometry to upset the apple cart. And maybe not, to just upset everyone, to spoil the party, and chalk that goal out. And then United win on penalties. It's so cruel. Like, it is so cruel because Coventry know in their heart of hearts they probably won't be back there. It's a once-in-a-lifetime kind of... once-in-a-generation, sorry, type of thing that happens, right? It might happen to another club, sure, but will it happen again to Coventry? Probably not. The odds say that it doesn't happen. And for that moment... And they could have been belted 6-0... in the final against City. They would not care because they got that moment. And to a certain extent, you can't... This is the thing about VAR. This is the thing. And because Coventry fans live in this pure... I was going to say utopia where there is no VAR. So for them, they haven't been conditioned to stop celebrating. They would have celebrated that goal like fucking no tomorrow when that ball went in, and only after it had got ruled out. So at least there's some solace in that. But it's the most cruel way to put the knife in so many kind of... to put the knife in the culture of English football and football in general, in my opinion. Because look... It's not like, maybe that's a little bit of a hyperbolic statement, and maybe it's hyperbole what I'm saying, and I'm catastrophizing a lot of things. But come on, like, really? I saw this tweet today. That guy in the VAR studio could have made that on side. I'm convinced that guy in the VAR studio could have 100% manipulated those lines to make it onside. And in the same vein, he could have and probably chose to make it offside. And I'm not saying it's his fault. I'm not saying it's match fishing. I'm not saying anything like that. But are we 100,000,000% sure that that is offside? Because I don't think we are, because those lines are as inconclusive as anything, in my opinion. Right? And subsequently, how is that any more conclusive than the linesman? How is that any more conclusive than the linesman who's literally in direct line with the player and can see it from the perfect angle? It's not an error drastic enough to ruin one of the purest moments in football for a long, long time. And I don't care about, yes, it's technically on offside, whatever. If it was technically offside, whatever. But if that player was onside, that goal still happens. If that player was a millimetre onside, offside, that goal still happens. I hate this robotic, everything needs to be perfect. Every single decision needs to be perfect. Human error makes everything happen. So the perfect example that I'll make, the Troy Deeney goal for Watford against Leicester, right? That only happens because Knockhart gets a penalty. And that wasn't even a penalty. Knockhart dived, clear as day. No way that gets given in a VAR day and age. No way. But that Deeney goal happened because Knockhart dived. Football karma comes back to you like a truck. Missed the penalty, go up the other end. Deeney scores, one of the best moments in football. In English football history and probably football history, especially in recent times. If that VAR happens, if VAR's a thing, that goal doesn't happen. None of that happens. Right? So it's not only just the fabric of it. It's just so much wrong about the way that it's going, and it's kind of been like I feel like it's a difficult kind of way to speak about it without sounding pretentious and without sounding like you are snobby and think more of the game than everyone else. Because at the end of the day, right? At the end of the day, you enjoy football how you enjoy football. I'm sure United fans couldn't give a fuck. And if I was a United fan, I couldn't care either, right? I'd probably be upset with my team's performance because 3-0 up against Coventry with 20 minutes to go, you win that game, right? You just do. And for you to only win that game through those circumstances would be disappointing. But I'm sure United fans don't care about that decision because, hey, one, they're going to Wembley again. They've got a chance to win silverware. Right, so they don't care, and I wouldn't care either. If I was Chelsea, I'd be like, "Fuck, we played like shit, but mate, we're going to Wembley. We're going to Wembley again. I don't care." So I get it from that perspective, from a tribalism perspective, I get it. But football cannot sit here and because it's more than just it's more than a lot of things. It's more than that. It's more than being perfect. The imperfections make it perfect, because so many memorable moments have come from. Not even refereeing decisions, but just imperfections within the game. Hand of God, an imperfection. Iconic moment. Like, Lampard's ghost goal. I mean, I've run into two World Cup incidents in a row, but Lampard's ghost goal against Germany. Iconic moment, made from an imperfection. And while at the time England fans were fuming, and maybe that's a little bit different because Golan technology works better in the way that VAR works, and I get it. But it's just an example of the fact of imperfections make the game perfect because there's injustices in the world. And football is a representation of society. So we can't sit here and live in a real world representation of society and not have imperfections and not have injustices, because that is not what it's about. If you want perfection and if you don't want any injustices, go play video games, go play FIFA, because every decision's correct on there, right? Every offside's correct, every fucking penalty, every free kick, everything's correct on there technically, right? Because they aren't the referees aren't programmed to make wrong decisions. So, like, there needs to be a level of, there needs to be a level of, yeah, I don't even know where I'm going with this. I told you this was going to be a rant, but it just frustrates me, right? Because Like, I mean, it even happened in the A-League as well this week. Like, there were some decisions, and maybe I'll touch on it if I've got time, but some of the refereeing decisions on the weekend were just fucking insane. And it's in the quest for perfection, we are becoming even more imperfect. And the frustration behind that is because if the game... it's a self-awareness of it, right? If the game embraced itself as an imperfect game, then the imperfections we accept because it's part of the game. But if we strive for perfection and end up getting even more imperfect, what are we doing? That's where the frustration lies. That's where the frustration lies. They all will never get it 100% right. Never. Football is far too nuanced for it to be 100% right. And football is one of the simpler games to kind of officiate, really. So football will never... like, there is no way it will ever get 100% right. So why are we in the quest for that? I just struggle. I really struggle to kind of accept that, because, like, look, you have to trust nature. You have to trust nature to do its course. Right, and this is like, you have to trust kind of the football, like the ball don't lie, essentially, is kind of what I'm getting at. Ball don't lie is essentially what I'm getting at, right? And whether it's immediate karma or not, when you interrupt the natural course of football through VAR, it ruins that. So there is always a... football always finds a way of working itself out one way or another. And the injustices within it do work themselves out. And yeah, there are teams that are unlucky. And yeah, there are teams that are luckier than others. And yeah, there are teams that have gone through on the pitch heartbreak a lot more than other teams, right? And I'm just talking about specifically decisions in games and moments in games, because clubs, like... I'm a Chelsea supporter. I don't know the next thing from heartbreak, right? At least we've got a club to support that's sustainable. On the pitch heartbreak, it always finds a way of working itself out. But when you interrupt that vibe with VAR, I think it does alter the course, I think, a lot. And interrupts it in a drastic way. I feel so sorry for Cobb. Like, I could not imagine it. It would be such a weird feeling of pride mixed with unbridled anger. Like, because they didn't lose the game. How do I describe it? They were in the game and they won the game off their own merit, but it got taken away from them because of VAR. And if it was the other way around, if they got into the game by VAR and lost it on their own merit, it would be a easier pill to swallow, because you can at least sit back and go, well, we didn't deserve to be there because of the VAR decisions. And you can probably accept that a lot quicker. But when you're there on your own merit, and when you score 3 goals off your own merit, lucky or not, you make your own luck. And VAR's not luck. It's not luck. I don't know. I can just imagine the pain. But commiserations to Coventry. That's fucked. I hope United get pelted in the final. Genuinely. And I really try and stay as neutral as possible on this, to give it like a solid kind of perspective on football. I hope City fucking pelt them, because... I don't deserve to be there. Coventry deserve to be there. But at the end of the day, what do I know? I'm going to speak about the Champions League very, very briefly. Because Bayern Munich won, beat Arsenal. I knew it. I fucking knew this was going to happen. Go back 3 episodes ago, wherever it was, where I said, it's the worst Bayern Munich team we've seen in the last 10 years. It's the best Arsenal team we've seen in the last 10 years. And Bayern Munich will still beat Arsenal, because there's just something about this club, or something about both clubs, that means, for whatever reason, they means that for whatever reason, Bayern Munich just have the wood over Arsenal as they go horrendously out of focus. Yeah, we're back. So, yeah, hilarious. And Saka's corner at the end was very funny as well. Speaking of the Real Madrid Man City game, horrendous penalty by Bernardo Silva. What the fuck is he? What are you doing, mate? Just score. Why are you trying to do that for, bro? And it was actually a good save as well for the Kovacic pen. But Real Madrid, undeniable, man. Undeniable in this competition. Real Madrid versus Bayern, semi-final Champions League. This is prime. Fuck. This tie, but in 2013. Oh. Real Madrid having, like, Di Maria and Ronaldo and Benzema. Higuain. With, like, Ramos, Carvajal, Casillas. Who, Modric was in the midfield? I can't even remember who was in that midfield, like, around about that time. And then Bayern Munich having, like, Robin, Ribery, Neuer, Boateng, Mandzukic, Lahm still. Oh, no, it was a Gomez up front. I think it might have been Gomez up front at that time. Just, if I can quickly find a lineup. Yeah, so they played in the Champions League in 2014. Do we have lineups? Oh, we have lineups. Listen to these lineups. And if this doesn't give you nostalgia, I don't know what will. So, the Bayern Munich lineup in 2014. Neuer, Rafinha, Boateng, Dante, Alaba, Lahm, Schweinsteiger, Ribery, Kroos, Robben, Mandzukic. Oh, that's so hot. And then the Real Madrid lineup: Casillas. Why did I say like that? Carvajal, Ramos, Pepe, Coentrao, Modric, Xavi Alonso, Di Maria, Isco, Benzema, Ronaldo. How hot's that? And then off the bench, Bale, Ilaramendi, and Varane. And you had, Xavi Martinez, Mario Götze, Thomas Muller off the bench. That was in 2014. If we go back to 2012, oh yeah, these lineups are even better. 2012, Badstuber as centre-back for Bayern Munich. Luis Gustavo playing in defensive midfield. For Real Madrid, Ozil playing in the number 10. Sami Khedira playing DM. Arbeloa playing right back. Marcelo, Higuain got subbed on. Muller got subbed on again. Kaka on the bench. What a time. What a time. Anyways, that was obviously the time which was the 4-3 on pens. That was the year Chelsea won the Champions League. That moment up there. It's on my wall. Technically. It is. I said technically it is. Anyways, I'm getting horrendously sidetracked. As I normally do on this podcast, great. Maybe that's what I'm going to do from now on. I'm just going to go through old games from really good periods of time in football and just read out the lineups. Like, I read, like, a Milan derby from, like, 2006. And it's just, like, Ballon d'Or winners fucking everywhere. Great. I'm getting sidetracked. Fucking shock horror. Yeah, and then I was going to speak about Chelsea losing, but fucking Nonny was laughing as Thiago Silva was crying, and Man City won. Who cares? Moving to Australian football. Let's transition. I should really get a sting when I transition, but I don't, and I can't be bothered. So, what do I speak about first? I'll speak about the Nolan Warren Awards, the Nolan Warren Awards. So, for those who don't know, so basically, I don't know if the Premier League have them, but I mean, the Premier League would have like the awards, not where they announce PFA Player of the Year and the Coach of the Year and Manager of the Year and blah blah, Young Player of the Year and stuff like that. It's an awards night. People glam up, wear their best black and white suits because no one has any creativity anymore, and they rock up. They accept their prize, have a few beers, and fuck off. Right? Good night. Good vibes. In Australia, it's far more of a big deal. In other codes, in the AFL, the Brownlow Medal, is a big deal. In the NRL, I'm not an NRL, Nuffy, Daily M's, I think that's what it is. Once again, big deal, they glam up, they get pissed, they get their award, and they fuck off. It's great. The A-League had it. It was called the Dolan Warren Awards. Yeah, the Dolan Warren Awards. And for whatever reason, I know the reason, and I'll touch on that, it's been scrapped in favour of just announcing the player of the year at halftime of the grand final. That's a way to do it. It's cost cutting measures by the APL in the most untransparent, just dumb way. I'm genuinely getting to the point now where I think that the APL will probably fold very quickly. There's just no money in it. Like, there is just simply no money in the APL. Like, there is nothing there. And the horrendous mismanagement of this league, I think, has... This is another case. This is another exhibit of just the horrendous mismanagement that has plagued this league ever since post the World Cup, right? And it's another instance of the fans and the match day goers and the hardcore fans of this league who actually care and give time and energy, and who Western Sydney is their number one team and who Melbourne Victory is their number one team. They are being cast aside, maybe not on purpose, but through a lack of communication in which makes no one in the situation look good. Because I'm sure the APL don't want to do this, but they have to do it and at least be transparent in why they're doing it. But instead they're making it like, oh, we're doing this for the fans and to like get more like fucking whatever. I don't know. I don't care. I don't know. But if you're just going to sit here and say, guys, we can't afford it. The money that we're normally going to take for this is now going to more like Western United Stadium or academies or grassroots football or pathways into the national team or whatever. At least be transparent. Then we'd be able to stomach it a little bit better. But you aren't, and we can't stomach it better for that reason. It's a massive shame. And once again, another kick to the dick of so many fans who are just being cast aside. It's a shame. Massive shame. But, I mean, do we expect anything different from... Do we expect anything different? I don't think so. Another unfortunate thing that happened, the Oliroos. The Oliroos lost drew their final qualifying match for the Olympics against... Let me quickly remember who it was, because... Yeah, whatever. It was against Qatar. It was the Asian Cup. It was the under-23s Asian Cup, which I think gave Olympic qualifiers to whoever. Which I think gave Olympic qualifiers to whoever got far or won it, or I don't know. I think it did. I think it definitely did. So if we look at the lineup that Australia played, surely they did a lineup. They did. So, some of the players that were in this team, you got Ryan Teague, Kane Farrell, Corny Perkins, Popovich, Taliano, Milanovic, Toure. On the bench, you got like Jordi Valadon, Filippo, Ali Kwol, Talbot, Garan Kwol. You've got really talented footballers who might not be Asian Cup level winning good, for under 23 levels, but are at least good enough to win a game in their group. They didn't. They drew 2-0 and lost 1-1-0. Now, I think it's Aurelio Vidmar who's the coach. It's very much Graham Arnold light. Which, hey, if you're Graham Arnold light, God, it screams of a total kind of It screams of a total systematic issue within Football Australia. Which is kind of similar to something to what I spoke last week about Iren Kunda, right? It's a total systematic failure from top to bottom. Asian Cup failure, World Cup success, but I think in spite of everything, not because of it. And the under-23s, Asian Cup failure. No Oliroos at the Olympics. And it's not like we did well at the Olympics last year anyway. We had one good moment against Argentina, I think it was, and then lost to Spain. Granted, Spain are very good. And then lost to Egypt. We lost to Egypt. Come on, guys. I sit here and speak about it most weeks, speak about Australian football and just continually disenfranchised, because at the end of the day, like, we scream and cry from the rooftops about how good this game is and about how much time and money should be put into it, and then there's just no return. On a national scale, on a domestic scale, on a governance scale, there's just no return. Screaming to the rooftop, screaming to a brick wall, and then nothing gets thrown back at us. It's such a shame. because the quality's good, the drama's good, it's great leg, best leg in the world, and it's just not given anything. There's one game week to go, final game week this weekend. Brisbane versus Adelaide with nothing on the line there. Newcastle versus Central Coast. Central Coast, top spot on the line if they win it. Oh, no, they've got two games in hand because their game was delayed. So Central Coast have top spot in their own hands, I'm pretty sure, as long as they get a point from one of their games, which is good. MacArthur still have the ability to finish in the top three. Still have the ability to finish in the top three and in first, sixth instead of fifth. If they win and then victory lose against Western Sydney, you still have the capabilities of finishing sixth. So that'll be interesting. Sydney and Perth. Sydney secured in finals and can't really move up a meaningful place. They can get a home final if they win and MacArthur lose or don't pick up a point. I don't know why I'm going through the permutations like this. I just feel like I am. And then Perth, rock bottom. West United, rock bottom. Well, as close to it as possible. And Melbourne City need a win to survive, to stay up, or a draw, or to stay in the finals, I should say. Stay in the finals. So yeah, there we go. That is all for today's episode of the 2 for Attack podcast. Thank you all very much for sticking around. As always, I have rambled a significant amount in this episode. So if you like me talking shit, this is great. If you want actual football analysis, probably not the place to be, but you've chosen to be here now. And if you're still here, you've watched the whole thing. So there you go. Thank you very much for watching another episode of the 2 for Attack podcast. As always, make sure you subscribe to all the socials that I said in the beginning. Stay well, stay safe. See you guys next week. And anything else I need to say? I don't think so. Stay well, stay well, stay safe. Goodbye.